is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
How are the Israeli elections likely to affect a free Palestine? And Israel's economy thrives on its exportation of urban warfare strategy and weaponry. The selling, if you will, of Gaza abroad. We'll speak with Professor Jeffrey Halper, director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, author and nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize. And I'm deeply into his book, which I actually just got and highly recommend it, which is An Israeli in Palestine. And welcome, Jeffrey, to our airwaves.
Thanks.
Kadima, Zivi Livni has edged out in the elections that were just held, the Likud party with Benjamin Netanyahu, but on the other hand, it didn't look like she would be able to form an actual election government. So why don't you walk us through where things stand now with the elections in Israel?
Well, we have a crazy electoral system here. You have 10, 12, 14 parties running. And no party gets close to a majority. You know, we have 120 members in our parliament. So you need 61 bare majority to set up a government. Well, the largest party in the elections is Kadima of Tzipi Livni, and they only got 29. So in other words, the largest party in the parliament is less than a quarter of the seats in parliament, which means there is no party that most Israelis, or even a third of the Israelis, or even a quarter of the Israelis support. So you have tremendous fragmentation. So Tzipi Livni or Netanyahu, who got less, he got 27 seats out of 120. They have to cobble together a government. They have to go find another 40-some seats from parties of 10 people, 5 people, 3 people. So you cobble together a government that doesn't really have a coherent agenda or an ideology or a program. It's just a matter of a government that lasts for a little while, it lasts for a year or two, and then it falls, and you have another one. So one of the problems is that you don't have an Israeli government, certainly that has a mandate to make peace. There is no Israeli government that I could see, even if it wanted to, that it would have the mandate to remove settlements and really see a two-state solution emerge. It's just not in the cards. And so Tzipi Livni will not be able to form a government because she doesn't have the right-wing parties in her camp, and the left-wing parties aren't big enough, even though Labor really isn't left-wing anymore. So Netanyahu will have a better chance of actually cobbling together this coalition, together with Avigdor Lieberman, who's a Russian immigrant, who really, and I'm using this word not in a slogan-y way, who's really a fascist. His main program that he ran on was to throw the Israeli citizens, who are Arabs, out of the country. So that it's a very racist, xenophobic kind of a party. And he became the third largest party. He got more seats than the Labor Party did. So you're going to have an extremely right-wing government of Netanyahu and Lieberman, which in some ways maybe is a good thing in the bigger picture from the point of view that it's going to be absolutely clear that the Israeli government is against any peace process, against any Palestinian state. And maybe that'll be easier for the Obama administration and Europe and others to begin to pressure Israel.
I don't want to accuse you of this, but somewhat of a depressing and nihilistic view that such a right-wing turn might, we hope, result in some international pressure that would move things forward with a peace process. But what does this actually mean, the rise of a party such as that run by Lieberman, and just for people here to make sure, not Joe Lieberman, although one wonders, but...
Yeah, what the difference is.
The fact is it's kind of almost like right, and writer. So what does this say about the understanding and consideration, particularly after the invasion of Gaza, of the Israeli population?
Well, you know, the whole idea of Zionism and of Israel was by itself racist. In other words, it made sense maybe in a certain way after the Holocaust that the Jews are persecuted and they should have a state of their own. I mean, there was a certain emotional sort of a thing, but it was never really thought out. And it was, you know, you can't have a country that's based on the privilege and even ethnic purity of one particular group. First of all, you can't do that. Second of all, Palestine wasn't an empty country. It was a country inhabited by another people. So the UN and the international community really had no right to say Palestine is now Israel, or most of it is now Israel, which is what it did. And then, of course, since 1967 with the occupation, Israel controls the entire country of Palestine, from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River. So you have a country that calls itself a Jewish democracy, whatever that means. It's a country in which, by law, Jews are privileged over others. It's really the antithesis of the American conception. The American conception of a democracy is a democracy of its citizens. Israel's very conception is racist. It privileges one group over the others. And so, you know, as long as there was a kind of a Labor Party, a leftist, a semi-socialist kind of facade to the whole thing, you know, it looked okay. And even people on the left sort of identified with Israel in a way. But now when the mask is off, and it's clear that with a growing Palestinian minority, the Palestinians are 20% of the Israeli Jewish population, but now we've got a permanent occupation of another 4 million, Israel has to become more and more oppressive of Palestinians in order to keep this Jewish... Now, it's not really a majority. Today, the majority of people in this country, in this Israel-Palestine, are Palestinians, not Jews. So now you've got a racist ideology and a racist system that looked liberal as long as the Jews were a large majority. But now that the Jews are the minority and still claiming privilege and still claiming to run the entire country, and this has to be a Jewish country and a Jewish democracy, it has to become more and more repressive, and that's where Lieberman comes in. Lieberman is basically articulating the essential dynamics of the country, and that is that this is a Jewish country, and if you're not Jewish, you either shut up or you get out, or we throw you out, or we kill you if it's a matter of Gaza. So I think we're beginning to see the underlying racism of the system coming to the surface. It shouldn't surprise anyone. Any country that claims to belong to one particular group has got to be racist. But I think now it's becoming clearer and clearer that that's the case.
Jeff, I just want to, for a moment, turn our attention back to the invasion, bombardment of Gaza City and the continued immiseration of the people. We're talking about over 1,000 people killed, maybe 40 to 50% of them, women and children, untold numbers of injuries, 20,000 houses demolished, and still an absolute lack of the kind of aid for rebuilding. But the reason I want to look at it is my listening to you recently during a trip here, which was rather stunning, and that was the question of the conducting itself of urban warfare amongst a citizenry, and also what that meant for the economy of Israel as they really begin to import or export, if you will, warfare strategies against civilian populations in heavily populated areas. And I thought that was a tremendously insightful, important, and frightening point that you had raised.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the slogans we use in the Israeli peace movement is we're all Palestinians. And we mean that from a solidarity point of view. But literally, we're all Palestinians, including Americans, everyone, from the point of view that we're all potential victims of urban warfare and counterinsurgency. Counterinsurgency, if we think of the term insurgents, the insurgents are the people. They're not the bad guys. They're the people. And Israel is pioneering in its warfare against the Palestinians. It's pioneering warfare against people. You see it in Nablus, you see it in Jenin, this kind of urban warfare, because that's where the people live, and you see it especially in Gaza. Why so many demolished homes, for example? Because Israel has pioneered a system that instead of the army coming down the streets of a city where it can be ambushed, it breaks into houses, and then it blows up the walls between one house and another so that the army is advancing through the city, through the walls of people's homes. and people getting killed on the way or terrorized on the way, their homes demolished and so on. So this is all terrible stuff. But Israel works very closely with the American military. It exports this system. It's been exported to Iraq. In Iraq, you have an American policy of house demolition. Tens of thousands of Iraqi homes have been demolished. It's the same system. Going through walls is something that the Russians adopted in Chechnya. And Israel works very closely with American police forces, so that we shouldn't think, or you shouldn't think, that these tactics and weaponry of urban warfare are going to be confined to Gaza. The Palestinians are merely the guinea pig. And this technology and these weapons and these tactics of urban warfare are being exported through your police forces into your own communities. And I have an article that's entitled, "The Road from Nablus, Gaza, and Fallujah Leads to Your Door." So that there's a whole global aspect here, an insidious global aspect that I think people are missing. So that's one of the things they're trying to point out. You can't explain the ferocity, the disproportionality of Israel's attack on Gaza by the security threat. There's no relation between the two. You can only explain it by the fact, first of all, that Israel wanted to completely destroy Gaza in order to deliver a message to the Palestinians that resisted, that you stop resisting and the occupation is permanent.
Beyond that, Jeff, it was
a field testing for these tactics and weaponry.
Jeff, I just want to probe that a bit more. Now, when you say they wanted to destroy Gaza, again, we're talking about a civilian population. Certainly, the media bloc tells us that it is Hamas that insists on infiltrating and being in the midst of a civilian population, as though Hamas had an army, which, of course, it doesn't. And therefore, the civilians inadvertently get victimized, not by the Israeli Defense Forces, but by Hamas. And I just want to explore that and the deliberacy of this in contrast to what you had spoken to me about and others during your recent trip here, which is, of course, the pacification policy that had already taken place with the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, and the contrast with Gaza.
Well, this is a process of pacification because Israel wants to make its occupation permanent. It is not, I mean, if maybe labor, the Labor Party, would think of a two-state solution, the best scenario is apartheid, which the Palestinians would get a little truncated Bantustan. But essentially, Israel wants to keep its control permanent. So the problem then becomes one of warehousing. How do you take a population of 4 million people? You know, people don't get warehoused permanently. They have no economy. 70% are living on less than $2 a day. They have no freedoms whatsoever, no rights. How do you keep this restive community pacified, quiet, warehoused? And what I'm suggesting is that this is a problem of the capitalist system in general, because in the capitalist system, more than half the people of the world are considered surplus humanity. They're not. There's no place for them. They're written off. You don't need them. They're not productive. They'll never be educated. So, again, I'm saying that Israel is developing here a model of how to pacify hostile populations that can be exported. In the United States, you've got millions and millions of prisoners in prisons, you know, that are being warehoused. You have so-called illegal immigrants. You've got poor people. I mean, look at New Orleans, for example. In other words, you have a lot of populations that have to be warehoused. And that's one reason why American police forces are working with Israel, because this is a police function, warehousing. So what I'm saying is we should start to look at the connections. I'm talking about kind of a global Gaza. What does Gaza really mean in terms of the civil liberties for Americans and for other people? I don't want to take away from the suffering and the resistance of the Palestinians, because we all have to support their struggle for national liberation, of course. But at the same time, we've got to be aware that Israel has a much wider agenda. You know, the Israeli economy is based largely on security and military. 60% of Israeli firms export in the security area. They run your airports, for example. And so the field testing of these kinds of weapons and devices and tactics that are used in warehousing in your airports or your communities are developed here in the occupied territories. That, I think, is a way to tell people, you know, you shouldn't be concerned about Palestinians only because of their own suffering and their own rights, but you should be concerned because you're Palestinians too. It's an American issue as well as a Palestinian-Israeli one.
I'd like to get a sense now, just moving back to the issue of the elections. First of all, what about the, incessant wrangling that will occur within the next weeks and the results of that in any event, which, as I said, still seem to be right, and righter? What does that mean for people such as yourself who are in the Israeli peace movement? What does it certainly mean for the Palestinians who are really on the edge in many ways of a complete, you would call it an ethnic cleansing, a genocide, certainly who have experienced recently a massacre?
Well, it means partly that the Israelis have abrogated all responsibility. They take no responsibility for anything. Even the so-called, there was one so-called peace party, Meretz. You know, it's supposed to be the party of peace. Peace, the occupation, Gaza, everything we've talked about, wasn't even part of their campaign. Their campaign revolved around the environment, environmental issues. So there is no, peace is not a political issue here in Israel. So it means that in a way it's been taken off the agenda. Israelis are doing fine. The economy is doing very well. I mean, it's suffering a little bit like all the economies, but that doesn't have to do with the occupation. The occupation, if anything, contributes economically. You know, the Israelis are feeling very secure. The international position of Israel improves every day. You know, when Israel invaded Gaza, in the middle, the American Congress almost unanimously passed a strong resolution supporting Israel and condemning Hamas. So Israelis are saying, you know, what's wrong with this picture? It's as good as it gets, especially because peace is impossible. So our control is complete. We've sold this to the international community. We're doing very well. So peace isn't even an issue in the political campaigns. Unfortunately, it means that if we want to support the Palestinians in their struggle for liberation, it's going to have to be done from abroad. And that's where boycott, divestment, and sanctions come in. We've got to start putting pressures on Israel from the outside, like we did with South Africa, because the Israeli public will simply not take responsibility, including the left. You know, the Meretz party was absolutely irresponsible, in my view, for not bringing up these issues in the campaign, and they got punished. They got 3 seats. The whole peace camp in Israel got 3 seats out of 120. So they're gone. And unfortunately, the ball is then in the international court. And it's not fair. You shouldn't have to be involved in getting Israel out of the occupied territories, but that's sort of where we are.
Well, as I said, in the weeks and months to come, we will continue to follow this. And I really do suggest strongly that people get a copy of An Israeli in Palestine, Resisting Dispossession, Redeeming Israel, Jeff Halper. It's put out by Pluto Press, and have to give credit where due and commend Jeff, whose life work really is an inspiration, whether it's blocking the house demolitions or delivering humanitarian aid and getting arrested for it, but certainly, most importantly now, educating all of us to why we knew to think of ourselves as all Palestinians. The implications are enormous for the warfare that is being conducted, and very often for some of us in our name, which we must reject, and we'll talk about that in our next segment. So, Jeff, thanks. We'll keep abreast of the issue.
And all right. Thank you very much for your interest and for having me on.
It's our pleasure entirely. And we've been speaking with Professor Jeff Halper, Director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, author and nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize.
in Montgomery and in Selma and the streets of Birmingham. The people sent a message to the leaders of the land. We have fought and we have suffered, but we know the wrong from right. We are family, we are neighbors, we are black and we are white. Here I go, bound for freedom, may my truth take the lead. Not the preacher, not the Congress, not the millionaire, but me. I will organize for justice, I will raise my voice in song.
Well, that's what we have to think about. We have to be bound for freedom. We have to have that sense of optimism and possibility, and we have to certainly understand that the struggle itself is a healing proposition. And somebody who has long been on that struggle, bound for freedom, is Dorothy Zellner, indeed from the streets of Birmingham and Montgomery, long involved. And we just had what I thought was a very probative and important discussion with Jeff Halper, and we're going to find out about how to act on it here.
Hi, how are you?
Well, you know, rough times, as they say, but we do push on, and I want you to tell us about a very important activity that I know you're immersed in and that benefits the world community, the people of Gaza, and certainly any peace-loving group of folks.
I want to tell the listeners that we're having a really unusual demonstration, a 24-hour street protest in front of the offices of the World Zionist Organization and the Jewish Agency. And the demonstration is being called by a group of individuals who are just calling ourselves Jews Say No. And I think the situation in Gaza has been so catastrophic that it has pushed all of us into a position where we just simply have to stand up. We have to say no. We can't allow this situation to go on. And furthermore, we can't allow these agencies who support, work hand in glove with the Israeli government, we can't allow the Israeli government to speak for all the Jews in the world. There are so many organizations that are popping up all over the country and in Europe and in Australia even, of Jews who are just totally fed up, and we are saying, no, this has to end. And the basic condition that is causing all of this misery is the occupation, and we have to say, no, the occupation simply must end. There will be no peace until Palestinians have justice. So that's what we're doing, and we're encouraging everyone to come. This is 24 hours. Come for an hour, come for 6 hours, come in the middle of the night. There will be people there in the middle of the night.
Well, it's always been our function, as far as I'm concerned, to help build people's movements and events and activities. And I can't think of anything much more important right then, now than Jews Say No, not in our name. But we also want to be clear that this is a 24-hour event where we're encouraging everybody to
Absolutely.
Be a participant. And I think it's great. Why the World Zionist Organization as a target?
Well, these are two leading agencies that work and support the Israeli government. The Jewish Agency inside Israel controls the access to land and decides who will be able to build a house and who will be able to purchase land from them. There's very little private ownership of land. The World Zionist Organization just literally faithfully promotes every policy of the Israeli government. And also, these agencies seem to act as if everyone in the world is a Zionist. Everyone in the world, or everyone in the Jewish world, I should say, supports everything that Israel does. And that's where Jews, in the Jewish community especially, have been, in my opinion, totally intimidated from asking questions and speaking out. And that is what is ending. That's going to stop. We are not going to be intimidated any longer by the established Jewish organizations. We're not going to be stand for being called self-hating Jews and so forth. We are going to do what, as Jews, we're supposed to do by the social justice tradition that we have, and we are going to speak up for justice.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing this. Remember that we must be all Palestinians. It is critical. And
yes, and I just wanted to say one more thing, Mimi.
Sure.
It's the Gazans who are there under 24-hour occupation every day, who can't travel, who can't move in and out, who have their water rationed, their electricity rationed, who aren't getting building supplies to rebuild. They're the ones who are in prison. So this is the least we can do, is stand there for 24 hours.
And so the slogan that was never again now is being used appropriately. Never again, not in Gaza, not anywhere. And Dorothy Zellner, thanks for all the good work you do.
Thank you, Mimi. Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Buildingbridgesradio.org.